newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ding-a-ling-a-ling.
The Media Project is underway. We hope that we won't depress you too much with bad news today, but that's where we will necessarily begin in talking about the media. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Hi, Chief.
Hey, don't call me Chief. There are probably few people now. Well, everybody in this room will remember that.
Did you know that the City Hall in Los Angeles, an iconic building, is the building that is portrayed as the Daily Planet in the TV show Superman?
I did not remember that.
Don't Call Me Chief emanated.
Yes, absolutely. Perry White. Ira Fussfeld, longtime publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Sir, how are you?
Nice to see you all.
Wonderful to have you back in town. And Rosemary Armeo is here, investigative journalist and former professor at UAlbany.
Hello.
What are you doing?
What am I doing? Taking care of my mother, elder care, and I'm going back to the university as an adjunct in January.
Good. Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing, you know.
Thank you for asking.
Keep you with all those young people asking all kinds of interesting questions, I think.
Mostly on campuses now, they seem to be shutting down speakers. I think it's kind of a disturbing trend.
That's quite a story.
Yeah, one that's happened at Binghamton.
Yeah. Jeff Sessions at Northwestern, which you guys talked about last week.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, in Binghamton, it was an economist, a conservative economist, the guy behind supply-side economics. And I guess he was an advisor to Trump, but he's not responsible for any of the things that mostly you hate Trump for. But he was just shouted down before he could speak. It's
unbelievable.
Crazy.
So we don't have a robust appreciation for the First Amendment, it seems.
That's what I worry about.
Yeah.
And today at UAlbany, there's a story that someone stomped into the snow, a negative message about Israel. And that was brought on by the Trump administration decision that the land grab, the Israeli land grab in Palestine, is no longer to be considered illegal.
And wouldn't you say, I won't put words in your mouth, but the media climate, the right-wing media versus the left-wing media, and the positions that are taken without room for compromise is dribbling down onto these college campuses?
Absolutely. I think it's a really unhealthy situation. And our coverage is dicey, too. And this isn't a criticism, Rex, because I understand where it comes from, but the coverage at UAlbany today was all about how it's anti-Semitism, which is how people who don't like the message frame it. It's not anti-Semitism is not the same as anti-Israeli politics. And so all of this gets confused. You know, you have a lack of tolerance for listening to the other side. Nuance is lost, and it's a travesty.
Well, I don't know that I buy into your absolute description here. I do think that when somebody says something terrible about Israel and puts a swastika next to it, that is an insult to all Jewish people.
And
that's different. Yeah,
and of course, the coverage, the article in question, which actually appeared on the front page of the Times Union, the UAlbany incident, I think it moved there in part because of the incidents preceding it. News play often is a result of the context when it occurs.
And I'm sorry, Rex, but nor am I saying that I know that there was a sticker in this case.
Right, yes. But the fact that people are labeling it as anti-Semitism, the news coverage simply picked up on what people were saying about it rather than us labeling it.
That's a very tough one.
And I
don't know how the media handles it, to be honest with you, because there are many American Jews, I think probably a majority, who are not in favor of Netanyahu and what he's doing.
Absolutely. But the tenor of the times in which people are so eager to be aggressive, because I think the tension that permeates from the White House is in fact a part of this. Dean Baquet, the editor of the New York Times, has said Donald Trump's rhetoric literally puts his reporters' lives at risk.
Hard to deny. I mean, fortunately, there has not been, to my knowledge, a crisis in that regard. But boy, it certainly makes reporters and editors look over their shoulders.
Oh, I don't know. I think that the killing of five people in the newsroom in Annapolis was a direct result. That was actually a Trump supporter who was attacking the media for its behavior. I would say there has been a rise in attacks on journalists, and I don't think the White House can credibly claim that it doesn't have a role in that.
Well, you know, once Trump puts out all this anti-First Amendment, anti-newspaper stuff, enemy of the people, there's going to be somebody who may have a few screws loose who is going to take that as an order to go and kill a reporter. It's that simple.
How do you get across respect for the First Amendment? It's an ephemeral concept. And what do you do when people feel as though, well, the First Amendment gives me the right to shout down a speaker who is, on his side, asserting his First Amendment right to speak? You know, this is, especially on a college campus, it is really difficult to determine where the First Amendment rights lie.
You know, Rex, in the old days, when I was at Hunter, very early before the dinosaurs, it was always the college that would say somebody couldn't speak, not the students. So the colleges, I remember the colleges were saying things like, Norman Thomas. Now, most people don't even remember who he was, but he was really the head socialist. And Norman Thomas couldn't speak. Now, half the schools in New York City are named for Norman Thomas. It's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, you also saw Donald Trump using the First Amendment as his excuse for what others have called intimidating a witness during impeachment inquiry this week. I can write anything I want about her, was Marie Yovanovitch.
Yeah.
And that also is a misuse of it. There's nothing in the First Amendment that gives you the right to attack, to spread hate speech. And, you know, unlike the Second Amendment, there are some reasonable limits and restrictions.
Well, unlike the Second Amendment.
Well, but the chutzpah factor here is what you're talking about, which is you call the press the enemy of the people, that being Trump. All of this terrible accusations about the quality of media and everything else. And then you say, I have a First Amendment right. That's chutzpah.
Yeah. I think there's massive need for educating on college campuses that anybody should be allowed to speak there. And if you don't like him, you don't go to the speech, or you go and you ask respectful questions. You actually discuss why you disagree and how you think this person is wrong. Unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, historically, the academy was, while you were a student, you would be exposed to all of these points of view, isn't it? And it helped mold who you were to become, but
Absolutely.
You were exposed to them.
Absolutely. I'm really sympathetic to this idea that every student on a college campus has to be made to feel safe and should not be confronted with ideas that offend them, if not actually endanger them. That's just not what that's not how you educate Americans.
Well, Ira, I have to take some differential with you on this, and difference with you, and that is that, as I remember it, back in the day when I was in college, if you were a communist, you weren't coming to the university.
Well, I can't cite chapter and verse. My recollection from my 4 years at New Paltz is that we had all manners of speakers points of view.
By that time, New Paltz was...
I don't think that that was a radical concept. Maybe some people did, but it was designed to expose students to what's going on in the world, and then you make your own judgments. Otherwise, where else would you experience these points of view?
This is a point made by the... I had a conversation this week with the president of Union College, David Harris, who makes a really interesting point that he has often said, that if a student ends 4 years in college without a significant challenge to something they believed, if they did not have a significant experience raising questions about something that is fundamental to them, they didn't get the kind of education they deserve. And so that's what your 4 years there, or however many years it takes a person to finish that undergraduate degree, ought to be a real challenge.
I think the connection with the White House, Rex, is not just First Amendment, but tolerance. That's what Trump has done away with, has helped to do away with in this country. And so you go into college, and when I was at Syracuse, I met an atheist for the first time. I met a vegetarian for the first time. And that was unheard of in my butcher family. And it was like, wow. And there was curiosity and discussion. And that's all gone. Now our knee-jerk reaction is, oh, that's weird. And you don't like it. And that comes from Trump. That comes directly from the White House.
Now, is there any connection? Tell me if I'm making too much of a leap here. The precarious state of local news, which is what I was alluding to at the top of the show when I said this has been a bad week for the news industry. The fact that local news is imperiled in so many communities, there are 200 counties in the United States with no news coverage at all. There are 1,800 or so counties in which there is no paper serving it, or when there may be one local weekly where there used to be five. There are so many news deserts now that there are many communities where nobody knows a reporter, nobody sees a reporter. Doesn't that have some impact on the loss of appreciation for other ideas coming to you, for other opportunities for exposure to concepts?
And even in those communities where there is a newspaper, the newspaper is underserving the communities because it cannot cover them as well as they used to.
So are we finding people conscious about this?
No, we're not, actually. Yeah. To that question, there's a new survey that surveyed 2,700 adults, a new Knight Foundation and Gallup survey. 56% of Americans think that their local news outlets are in good shape financially. 63% think outlets outside their area are doing well financially. But only 14%, I think, are actually paying for the news. So this is really a significant finding when we who are engaged in the industry understand the financial peril. You know, my newspaper makes a profit. The company that owns it makes a lot of money through other industries. And yet we continue to shed jobs, and so does every news outlet that I know of. And here's the really bad news. Some of these terrible companies that have been just tremendously aggressive at stripping away the core of news coverage are now rising up. Gannett and Gatehouse merged, two media giants, to create the biggest newspaper company in the world. And now a quarter, the controlling interest of Tribune Publishing Company, has been bought by Alden Global Capital, a notorious hedge fund, about which Ira has some experience.
Well, I do. I mean, they own my former newspaper, among others. But, you know, I look at this in the larger context without trying to or being unable to defend the hedge fund. So let's put that marker down. But, you know, I've been retired 6 years already, and I think about this a lot even now because I can see the product each day of the week, not just mine, but others. This is a discussion that we had in our industry and in front of these microphones more than a decade ago, probably 15 to 20 years ago. We all saw this coming. We all began to wring our hands. Newspapers were tightening belts long before the hedge funds got involved. And in light of all of the hand-wringing that was being done in the industry, nothing came about that I'm aware of that stopped it. So the inevitable charge continued. I think I said here, is it the fault of the hedge fund, which purchases a property, that the hedge fund is doing what hedge funds do? Or is it the fault of the company that sold the property to the hedge fund and now bemoans what had happened to their former property? Or is it just simply an acknowledgement that the hedge funds are the only ones left who are interested in owning these publications because they see a reason to do what it is they're doing to them because they don't think they're going to be alive that long anyway, so let's just take what we can out of them before they die?
So let me ask you guys this. Obviously, you know, people have been buying these newspapers in large numbers and combining newspaper services. So what, were they stupid? Did they not know that their ideas where they thought they could make money were not going to pan out? Or
the purchasers?
Yeah.
No, the purchasers, well, now that it's dribbled down to the hedge funds know what they're getting into, and there is still money to be made in newspapers, but there is not a good long-term outlook for the print product at the very least.
Okay, so for the rest of us, Ira, what is it that you say they know that what they're getting into?
They're stupid if they're not looking at the circulation and revenue numbers and not seeing that they're in an inexorable decline.
Inexorable decline. They're stripping out the assets they can.
Mm-hmm. You know, I haven't seen a profit and loss sheet since I retired.
Okay, Rex, can I go to you? Yes, what do you mean they're stripping out the assets that they can?
Well, they're making money and flying the plane into the ground. They're basically taking away its airworthiness. For example, if you sell off the real estate, you can make money from that. If you reduce the number of pages, you can...
Well, let's take them one at a time. So if you sell off the real estate, you rent something and you don't
reasonable.
Own the building anymore.
That's not a
and
terrible thing.
You don't need
as
large a facility as newspapers used to have because the staffs are much smaller.
But if you're charging somebody $300 a year, say, for a daily paper that really has almost no news in it, your readers are eventually, or pretty quickly, going to figure out, you know, I don't really need that anymore. Mm-hmm. And so for a while, you can make that money, and you can just make as much as you can until your revenue has diminished so much, your circulation has dropped, that your newspaper is worthless. And then what's going to happen to it? You know, we print Iris' former paper and a couple of its small sister publications, the Saratoga paper and the Troy paper that I was the editor of in the early 90s. Iris Former paper is still pretty healthy. The other two are, I mean, relatively healthy by comparison to a lot of community newspapers. Kingston is a solid community. These other papers don't have much of a future, frankly. What's going to happen when those newspapers go away? I'm not going to have enough staff to cover Saratoga and Troy as effectively as a local newspaper does, should.
Two amendments. One is, even with the smaller staffs that most daily newspapers are working with now, the news content that they are producing is generally still more than, certainly more than if there was no newspaper.
Right.
And it's just less than there used to be. So to your point, if people are not reading their local daily newspaper, even under its current reduced form, they're still missing out on local news, whether it's Cop News or Obits, which has always been the center of local small newspapers.
Or planning boards and town boards and
less
school
of
boards.
That.
Yeah, a little bit less than that. Here's the comment, I think, well put by the chief executive of PEN America, which put out this new report. The first draft of history is not being written. It has completely disappeared. That's what's so chilling about this crisis.
So let's begin. I don't want to paint the hedge funds as nice guys necessarily, but if the hedge funds don't buy these papers from Tribune or from wherever they're buying them, then what? Will the papers go out of existence sooner than later? The answer is probably yes.
Well, here on the Media Project, we have been discussing alternatives. One is the Berkshire Eagle model in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. A very enterprising former judge gets a group of people with a lot of money to say, you can have whatever you need, basically. And I just get a thing in the mail saying, because we've been doing a good job, and they have, you should pay us more money than you've been paying us. So that $300
yeah.
a year model. But I think there are a certain number of people who say, no, I don't want to pay more money, no matter how good you are. And that endangers it even further. The other thing we've been talking about here on the Media Project is whether newspapers should become not-for-profit. And we don't see an awful lot of that happening, but it's a possibility.
I heard that discussion last week. Let's take as an example. I'll try to be fast. And nothing, Alan, that I'm going to say is negative to WAMC. Don't take it that way.
I will take it that way.
WAMC has three fantastic fund drives a year, raises $1 million in each of the three fund drives.
It also Too bad nobody writes about it in the paper.
No. It also has a revenue stream from underwriting, and it has a revenue stream from foundations or grants and the like.
Yeah.
And that is enough money to do a terrific job with the number of people you have. You have a larger newsroom than virtually any other radio station of this size. All of the good things. Now, let's take, if that model were to go to the Daily Freeman of Kingston, New York, you are able to solicit funds from seven states, plus whoever listens to you on the internet from around the world, literally. The pool for a Daily Freeman size community is significantly smaller. But let's say we were as successful as you are and raised the exact same amount of money as you do. We couldn't run that newspaper on that amount of money.
Because newspapers are expensive to operate.
Newspapers are expensive to operate. If we could raise $10 million a year, again, I haven't seen a P&L in a long time, that would not do the trick for the newspaper that needs to hire more people and all the rest.
So we are looking at different models. So now
yes.
I leave the Berkshire Eagle and I go to something called the Berkshire Edge. And the Berkshire Edge sends, 10,000 people every morning electronically. It's not on paper, but it's a different model. And an awful lot of people are reading it, I know, because I'm hearing more reaction than I ever saw on the Berkshire Eagle.
And in that publication, there's not investigative reporting. There's not close watchdog journalism looking over the local governments. It's easy to collect things that you don't have to have any kind of training in. I think left out of all this really interesting discussion that we're having
Because I don't think you're right about the investigative journalism. What happens is there is investigative journalism, but it's not nearly as consistent as the old investigative journalism. So somebody can put a piece out that will get a lot of people saying, I've seen it again and again on the Berkshire Edge.
Well,
it happens.
How many reporters do they have?
One.
Well, they're not going to.
I'm comparing that with the Boston Globe that's coming out this week with an amazing series looking at traffic in Boston.
Yeah, I get it.
Have you looked at it?
I've seen it.
I mean, it's the kind of reporting where you look at something that's there every day and it's, we're going to take another look at this, which makes you think differently, that will result in changes in policy and design of the city. That sort of work, which is the only reason, in my mind, that makes journalism worthwhile.
The LA Times is currently doing a series on homelessness, which is
correct.
A horrible problem
correct.
Out there. Every day, two or three stories on the front page.
So that's all lost. And we have to look. The business model, which you have been discussing really interestingly this morning, is part of it. The other part are readers and viewers who we've already seen from the story you cited don't understand the financial problems. They also don't understand how news gets to them. They no longer value it. They think, oh, I can just go on the Internet. I'll read it online.
Okay, so Rex and Rosemary,
right?
Free.
There's no awareness of where this comes from.
Okay, so Rex and Rosemary and Ira, it seems to me a Boston Globe or an LA Times, which does this excellent reporting, a lot comes down to who's running the newspaper. I have to say Rex does a terrific job here with the Times Union. I read stuff all the time that I had no idea that was happening. But there are papers that don't do that, and they are going to be failures, aren't they?
Already are. They're already gone.
Not because they're stupid. They recognize there are stories to be written, but they just have to make a choice. If we send out one or more reporters to do an investigative series that takes their daily coverage out of the paper for weeks on end, what is going to fill the paper?
We saw that. A perfect example of that in our region is the Poughkeepsie Journal. They used to all kinds of great investigative pieces, and now they don't.
And by the way, if I can allow myself to be defensive, Poughkeepsie Journal is a Gannett paper, now a Gatehouse paper. It's not an Alden paper. They've suffered significant contraction. Their editor, I believe, is now the same editor as in the Rockland County Gannett paper. Our friend Stu Shinsky, who used to be on this panel, the editor of that paper, an award-winning paper, used to bring... The last time I was at a state publisher's awards dinner, I offered to carry some of the plaques home for Stu because they won so many.
It was very heavy, absolutely.
And yet then turn around and they let him go with the contraction.
Eliminated the job. There's no editor of that paper anymore.
I don't want to give you a hard time, Ira, but I think that's what I was saying.
Okay.
Yeah, all right.
I mean, you know how much I like to reinforce
I don't think there's a market. I do not think there's a market for news. That's ultimately it.
What do you mean?
The value, even if you have a wonderful newspaper doing investigative reporting and covering your community, who's reading it? Not young people, not my college kids.
But
not.
What do you, is there, so how do you make that happen? So Americans don't care anymore. How do you make it happen that people care about these things? So
yeah,
maybe the traffic in Boston is something that people will care about. Homelessness, will they care about? I mean, I don't know. What we're doing stories that I think are consequential in the world of politics and government that sort of speak to how the state operates, for example. But I don't know that our everyday readers care as
That's a really good quote. Right now, the coverage on Jacob in the Times Union is fascinating.
And Jacob, Rosemary,
it's the state ethics investigator, basically.
Which is referred to...
And it's all very twisted up right now with the governor.
Which, as we all know, is referred to as J-Joke. And right now the question is...
Well, we don't all know that. That's my point, is that I think that people are saying, oh, I have to get the Times Union or I won't know about Jacob anymore.
If only.
Well, except government is the industry of this town in many ways. And so people want to know if the governor was doing something bad or the speaker of the assembly was doing something bad and getting inside information that they shouldn't have been getting.
Yeah, I'm kind of banking on that, but it's not as big as the number of people who would care about something more sensational, you know, that touches their lives daily.
I mean, every day right now, you can turn on the television and watch hours of the most sensational news in the impeachment. I'm talking about the impeachment trial that I have ever seen. There is nothing, I'm sorry, in the Times Union that can compete with that,
right,
or the Kingston paper. No community paper, which does an entirely different job, can compete with that. And yet our readers, our viewers, that's what they say. When they say they want local news, they want Monica Lewinsky stories at a local level. That's what they want.
Ooh, yeah. Mm. And that you can't, that's not what we deliver, is it?
No.
Though if you do look at the statistics, what people are looking at online, because we can trace exactly which stories have resonance.
So how many clicks?
Well, actually, we're looking just a little bit. It's a different metric. We're looking at visits, and we're even looking at stickiness, like how long do people spend with a story?
Yeah.
And we talk about that in our afternoon meeting where we decide what's going to go on the front page and how we're going to play stories. The first thing we talk about is what's playing digitally, knowing that digital is different from print, but we just want to know what are people paying attention to all the time. The number one thing usually is crime news.
And that's true of this radio station also. We don't do a good job with crime news, by the way. But we do see the differences between who's listening on the radio going down and who's listening digitally going up.
Yeah, which is fine. You know, actually, if you can make that transition, God bless you. That's going to be really terrific if WAMC.org becomes the powerful force that the radio stations have been. That's the future.
Well, obviously. Wasn't there a time on this station where you purposely didn't cover crime
isn't
news?
Isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was. There was, and I think some of that still is around.
Sure.
I think it's a mistake, to tell you the truth. I think there's a certain coverage of crime news that ought to be there. I don't think that our bureau chiefs are doing that now. And I don't know, as a reader or as a listener, I'm always interested in did something terrible happen. Right here where the radio station is on Quail Street, Rex, we had 3 crimes in one day. And they were really awful crimes. So I think people want to know where to go and how to do it and whether they should take their lives in their hands.
But the argument could be made, and I think you used to make it, that the audience for an NPR affiliate or for a public radio station, they're not in the market for the crime news. We're going to leave that to the tabloids.
Well,
and that we go to WAMC because the news is more substantive.
Well, I don't think it's either or. I think it's both.
I'm thinking as you talk that, okay, I didn't know that there were 3 crimes on Quail Street, but I can tell you all about the corruption of the Massachusetts State Police right now.
Yeah.
And that's what I was reading.
Yeah.
It's like as our audience has become more global, they're trolling a wider field for the stories that they spend time with. So J. Cope is going to lose out to the traffic story in Boston, even here, where traffic is a lot less, but everybody drives.
And it's all going to lose out, and this is what's scaring the hell out of me, to Trump. I mean, you know, Trump is everything. Andrew Cuomo has done some things that maybe some people don't like, but you're probably not going to learn about it because everybody's paying attention to these hearings and everything else.
Exactly.
Well, I don't actually know that everybody's paying attention. The audience is not as huge as it might be.
Is that right?
I've not seen the numbers. Do you have that? I thought there were more watching than they had expected.
Yeah, I heard that.
More than they had expected, but that is not as many as would typically watch, not as many, for example, as watch the Watergate hearings.
Different media feel, though. You know, that was, I mean, you were watching it because there was nothing else to watch in 1972.
Yeah, right. Now we have Judge Judy. Okay.
We need more than a half hour.
There we go. We're down and out of time, and we haven't even offered you an opportunity to write into media@wamc.org. We would always welcome your comments. Alan Shartok, Rosemary Armeo, Ira Fussfeld, and I'm Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us this week on The Media Project.
To working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.